Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, celebration in El Salvador, the life and legacy of Archbishop Oscar Romero in the spotlight 30 years on from his assassination. The origins of our species. The new Templeton Prize winner discusses the dialogue between scientific knowledge and religious belief. But first, the mysterious Shroud of Turin will go on public display again for 5 weeks, beginning on April the 10th. Dubbed the most enigmatic artifact the world has ever known, and it goes on public display for the first time in a decade between April the 10th and May the 23rd this year in Turin's Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. Yes, of course, it's the Shroud of Turin, a badly damaged and blood-stained burial cloth which many believe was used to wrap the body of Jesus himself after his crucifixion on the hill outside Jerusalem. Despite carbon dating tests over 2 decades ago, which declared the shroud had originated in the Middle Ages, scientific research continues to probe the mysteries of how and where the image of a man's body on the cloth was produced.
Quindi 2 maggio. Santo Padre sarà a Torino per la celebrazione eucaristica, ma soprattutto per una sosta di preghiera, di meditazione davanti al sindone.
In the Vatican on Thursday, the Archbishop of Turin, Cardinal Severino Poletto, announced that Pope Benedict XVI is due to make a pilgrimage to the city on May the 2nd to see the shroud, and over 1 million people around Italy and beyond have already booked a visit to the cathedral during this 5-week public viewing. You can find lots more details on the English, French and Italian website www.sindone.org. That's www.sindone.org. A Spanish-American professor of evolutionary genetics and molecular biology has won the 2010 Templeton Prize, an annual award to an individual who's made significant contributions to research into spiritual matters. Professor Francisco Ayala from Irvine University, California, was named on Thursday as the recipient of the $1 million prize. Ayala, who was born in Madrid in 1934 and moved to the US in the 1960s, became a pioneer of genetic research, working especially on the origins of malaria and other tropical diseases. He also developed highly accurate ways of reading genetic clocks to determine the evolutionary process, and is a vocal opponent of religious beliefs that refute scientific evidence for evolution. In 1981, he served as an expert witness in a pivotal US federal court challenge by religious groups seeking to teach creationism in schools alongside evolutionary science. Ayala, who became a Dominican priest for a short while, holds up both science and faith as 2 distinct but essential ways of understanding the natural world and the meaning of life on Earth. I caught up with him as the prestigious prize was announced in Washington to find out more about his work and his views on the dialogue between faith and science.
You know, I came to the United States in 1961 to study science, specifically genetics and evolution. And that's how my career has developed, studying fundamental problems of evolutionary genetics in species and the origin of species and specific problems like the molecular clock. In recent years, I have been doing a lot of work concerning some parasitic diseases, major diseases of humankind, like malaria and Chagas disease. But all along, particularly over the last 20 years or so, I became aware of this attitude of many American religious people of faith, who think that science, and specifically evolution, is contrary to religion, and therefore they reject science. And I think that's very unfortunate, because not only I think they are compatible, I believe and I argue that the theory of evolution and science is more compatible with the Christian faith and with the faith in general in a personal God than those theories that go around by the names of creationism or intelligent design, which have implications very negative with respect to the notion of God that they imply.
Why do you think these views, these theories, have such a wide following, particularly in the U.S. today?
Well, because, as you know, the United States is a very religious country. 85% of the population consider themselves either religious or very religious, which is a much higher percentage than it would be in Italy or Spain or France or many other parts of the world. Now, these people have a simplistic view of creation, and God creates by just the way in which a sculptor creates a sculpture, or an artist designs something, or an engineer, and they don't realize that God indeed can create through the natural processes, the process of evolution in particular concerning humans. So the naive reaction is that scientific explanations try to exclude God from the explanation. And the scientific explanations exclude God because science has nothing to say about God. It does not exclude God in the sense that they will be antagonistic to faith in God, which is the way in which many people interpret it.
As you say, you've dedicated a lot of your writing, a lot of your work, trying to put forward this balanced relationship between faith and science. And yet, in many ways, it seems that these two worldviews are moving further apart. I mean, what else can people like yourself, prominent scientists, do to try and change this?
Well, I think with writings for the general public, and also with presentations. You know, I give lectures at universities and at churches and at seminaries and at religious groups, as well as to the general public, trying to explain the compatibility between science and religion, and also trying to explain that the scientific knowledge is very important for the progress of humankind, and also the scientific knowledge, the theory of evolution in particular, gives a very exciting view of what we are, what the world is like, and what we humans are.
You talk about the importance of keeping these two areas separate. And yet, is that really possible in your work?
Well, what one has to keep separate are the theories and the notions implied, simply because they are completely different subjects. You know, science tries to explain the makeup of matter and the expansion of the galaxies and the evolution of organisms. Religion deals with our relationship to God and to each other and with moral values and the meaning of life. So they are different subjects, so they should not be intermingled, and they should be separate in that sense. But on the other hand, I argue consistently for a dialogue between the two, particularly in the sense that you have to make it understood that the science is not contrary to religion, to religious faith.
Religious faith has always played an important part in your own life, hasn't it? You even became a Dominican priest for a while, but then decided the priesthood wasn't for you. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I studied physics at the university. That was my subject at the University of Madrid. Then I went into the Dominican order and studied theology for 5 years. And by the time I was ordained a priest, I had already decided that what I wanted to do is to have a scientific career dedicated precisely to investigate genetics and evolution. And I discussed the matter with my superiors, and they agreed with it. So I never was a parish priest or practiced as a priest or monk in a consistent manner after I was ordained. I just started to study science and evolution, and that's how my career developed.
That was in Spain in the Franco era, wasn't it?
Yeah, I grew up in Franco's era, but I left Spain to study in New York at Columbia University in 1961. So the change took place the United States, when in the United States where I became a scientist. I got my PhD in genetics and evolution, and then I started to dedicate my life to as a faculty member in universities here.
And what role would you say that faith plays in your work, in your life today?
Well, I see it only in terms of dialogue. I try to advance the possibility of this dialogue between science and religion. At my personal level, I prefer not to bring in what my faith is or is not, because I don't want to be judged by either side, that is the people who are anti-science, the people who are anti-religion, that the positions I take is because I am a person of faith or because I am not. What I am trying to say is that my views concerning the dialogue and the compatibility between science and religion are completely independent of what personal beliefs that one may have. And this is the reason why I try to propagate this dialogue or this perception that there is no opposition, because I think it's independent of whether people have religious faith or not.
Do you see a greater opening up within the mainline churches towards this view of a dialogue, a fruitful dialogue between faith and science?
Oh, very definitely. In the Vatican, you had already, Pius the 12th, made some statements about evolution as a still was referring to it in 1950 in the Encyclica Humani Generis as a theory compatible with Christianity, with the Christian faith. But then John Paul II had in an address in October of 1996 to the Academy, the Pontifical Academy of Science, which is a very forceful statement about evolution, pointing out evolution is no longer a hypothesis, but is a rather well-corroborated theory, and affirming its compatibility with the Christian faith. And the present Pope also has made statements along those lines. So I think this in the Catholic Church, but now many of the mainstream Protestant churches have made explicit statements affirming the compatibility of science, and in particular the theory of evolution, the compatibility with the Christian faith, and so have Jewish religious entities as well as Muslims.
Thanks there to the 2010 Templeton Prize winner, Professor Francisco Ayala. Years on from his assassination, the life and legacy of Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero is being celebrated this week by people in his native El Salvador and by church leaders in countries across the globe. Known by local people simply as Monsignor, Archbishop Romero was shot dead on March 24, 1980, while saying Mass in the small chapel where he lived in the capital, San Salvador. The day before his assassination, he had openly challenged the military leadership in a homily broadcast across the country, urging soldiers not to follow orders and kill or oppress their fellow citizens. 3 decades on from his death, Romero is revered by many as the voice of the voiceless, an inspirational figure for all who struggle to uphold the gospel values of human dignity, justice and peace.
There is a real love for Archbishop Romero. People see him as a father of the nation.
Among those marking the 30th anniversary in San Salvador this week is former director of the English Catholic Aid Agency, CAFOD, Julian Filikowski, who is also the founder and chair of the UK-based Romero Trust, set up to promote greater awareness of the life and legacy of the assassinated Archbishop. I spoke to Julian on Wednesday to find out more about the celebrations in the Salvadoran capital.
It's a national day for the first time today. It's Monsignor Oscar Romero Day, and a tremendous way for the country, the legislature, the president of the state of El Salvador to recognize Archbishop Romero as the spiritual guide of the nation, and as the president said last Saturday, the greatest Salvadoran patriot in its history.
So what has the atmosphere been like this week for these celebrations that have been going on?
Well, there's been a real explosion of events and liturgies, activities. There's been a Congress of Theology all week with distinguished theologians from all over Latin America and Europe here speaking. Bishop Ramazzini from Guatemala was speaking. There was a spectacular mass on Saturday evening with a candlelit procession from the Square of the Americas down to the cathedral, and the mass celebrated by 52 priests and 10 bishops, of which the Archbishop of San Salvador was presiding, the whole square full of people singing, and really a fantastic atmosphere. Today is Romero Day, and there are liturgies all over the country, but there's a special mass in the cathedral at midday, which is the official mass, of which Cardinal McCarrick, former Archbishop of Washington, is coming down, and there are bishops from Germany, from South America, and other places joining in this celebration. In the airport, the international airport, the president is going to unveil a huge mural, 12 meters high, of Romero as a way of commemorating his commitment, so that all people visiting El Salvador, the first thing they'll see is Archbishop Romero. So these activities have been going on. There's been just an amazing, all I can say is an explosion of activity.
Cynical people would say, isn't the government really perhaps now cashing in on this figure in an attempt to perhaps exploit him in some way?
I don't think so. Archbishop Romero has been ignored. They tried to write him out of history for the first 25 years after his martyrdom. Now, for the first time last year, has come a government to power which is very sympathetic towards him. The president himself has got great devotion to Archbishop Romero, and he's dedicated his presidency to Archbishop Romero. But the proclamation of a national day was done by the whole Congress, by people from nobody voted against it. It was from most of the major parties. If you wish to see political manipulation, of course you can see it, but there is no political manipulation. Archbishop Romero is a national figure. He unites this nation. He unites people in the church worldwide. And to try to see him as a divisive figure, I think is just mistaken.
Amongst those who are celebrating this anniversary of his assassination, of course, there are many who knew him personally, whose family members perhaps were persecuted or killed by the regime just as he was.
There is a real love for Archbishop Romero in the celebrations. People see him as a father of the nation. They see him as a guide. People pray for his intercession to guide them, to give wisdom, to strengthen their mission. And I have the sense around here, with the people I've been around with this last week, that people leave here at the end of today strengthened in their faith, with renewed hope in their mission, their ministry, and I think with just a greater generosity of love for the poor and of commitment to solidarity. He is just such a great witness. He's an icon of holiness for this 21st century, and people just want to embrace him as someone who spoke the truth. He spoke the unvarnished truth, in season, out of season, to the right and to the left. He spoke the truth in a world of lies, of cover-up, and of denial. Everything he did was characterized by his loving and compassionate service, that is Caritas. I keep saying to people today, Archbishop Romero is really a Caritas in Veritate bishop. He is a man of love in truth, absolutely suitable for our times. And he unites people from every sector, people who are more conservative and people who are more liberal, people who have a profound and deep spirituality, people who are more social activists. He brings them all together as his person, as someone who unites. He's loved in our Catholic Church all over the world, and he's loved in the there are Lutherans here, there are Episcopalians here in San Salvador who have come specially to celebrate him. A great figure of unity in the Christian churches.
As you say, there are delegations of church leaders from many different countries. What do you think perhaps is his international appeal in the sense, as you say, a model for people today?
Well, I think that he is captured around the world precisely because of his credibility. He is a credible witness in this doubting, sceptical, postmodernist age. He's a credible witness of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He talks the talk in terms of his profound spirituality, his love of God, which led him to his love of the poor, and which was inseparable from his love of the poor. He talked the talk, and in the midst of the injustice, when he proclaimed rights for all, when he proclaimed the dignity of everyone, he walked the walk, and he walked to the very end till he gave his life for his people, for his church here, and shot dead at the altar. Again, such an iconic picture, an iconic martyrdom, that I think he is such an attractive figure for people, young people. There have been lots of youth activities. For confirmation classes, he's a great example. For diaconate training, he's a great example. An attractive person, it seems to me, for this 21st century world, something that the church has to offer the world.
How would you say the church there in Salvador today is carrying on his legacy, this mission of service to the poorest of the poor?
The work goes on. Romero is present, and the work he did goes on. The legal aid office he started still goes on in the archdiocese. I think the country has been through a horrendous period of civil war, but things are returning. It's not the same place, it's not the same country, but there is something spectacular that Archbishop Romero brought, which many people, you know, are determined and will in the church continue to allow to flourish. The new archbishop is pursuing the cause and trying again to see Archbishop Romero as somebody who's going to unite this church.
Julian Filikowski there, founder and chair of the UK-based Romero Trust. Among the many church leaders visiting El Salvador during this anniversary week is Bishop Arthur Roach from Leeds in the north of England. He told me more about his participation in the celebrations and about the work that CAFOD is doing today to carry on the legacy of Monsignor Oscar Romero.
He himself said any days before he was assassinated that they may kill me, but I shall rise again in the people of El Salvador. And I think that's really very clear to see. It's very touching as you go around not only the city but other places within this country. And you know that you're standing on very hallowed ground. Much blood has been shed on nearly every street of this city and elsewhere, and you have the assassination of Romero in the Hospitalito where he lived and where he was celebrating Mass on the 24th of March in 1980. But then, not too far away, the university where those six Jesuits and the two Huskies were taken out and premeditatively murdered on the lawn of their house. And so many cases. I met a woman as we were going down to the cathedral the other day, and she said to me, I now live in Canada, but my children were all executed. And I wanted to come back and to thank Monsignor Romero for having actually made people aware of everything that was happening. And it's that sort of witness that you know has with someone coming all the way back from Canada to say thank you to him, and all the people from the countryside coming in because they recognize in him someone who believed in them and defended their rights for dignity. This very holy man who probably thought that he was quite insignificant in many ways, but has now become really a shining light for this nation and perhaps for the whole of Central America.
And also well beyond Central America, of course, he is an icon or something of an inspirational figure to many people working in justice and peace in other countries, other continents even. What do you think, perhaps, if you had to identify what it is that makes his legacy so significant to those working in these kind of movements today?
I think his simplicity, his reflection that through the gospel was very penetrating of the situation in which he was living and which people today see in replicated in other parts of the world. I think also that he's become quite an ecumenical figure. People of other churches recognize the authenticity of this man's life. For example, in England, I'm aware that York Minster begins the celebrations for the 30th anniversary of the death of Oscar Romero. And that will continue in different dioceses. The Archbishop of York, together with the Cardinal Archbishop of Edinburgh, will preside at the Minster. But then also at Westminster on the final day, Palm Sunday, the Archbishop of Canterbury will be there with the Archbishop of Westminster to honour, to recognise the extraordinary work of this man. And really to, in recognising that work and in commemorating it, to say to the world, you know, we must not forget the plight of the people.
He is revered, as you say, as a saint there in El Salvador and throughout Latin America, and yet he hasn't officially been recognised as such, as a saint. Is this a disappointment for some, do you think, still?
I think that the people, certainly of El Salvador, are very anxious that he should be recognised. It is true that they look upon him as a saint. But there's also, you know, wisdom in the church, never rushing these things and seeing how best he can be commemorated. And I think the process is going forward quite steadily.
You talked about CAFOD continuing the work, continuing his legacy there. What perhaps are some of the most significant projects that you've seen or ways in which this work is going forward?
Well, they work in three very clear areas here. They work in the area of education, young people. The other day I was in a region of the city, very, very impoverished indeed, called La Chaca, where there is a school there in what is known as a red area. In other words, it's a very dangerous area. It's a very perilous area. There's a great deal of violence there. And the Carmelite sisters have 800 children. And it was an absolute delight to visit the school. And it was an even greater delight to meet the young people who are being educated there, because we asked them all sorts of questions, but one of the things that repeatedly came from them was that they appreciated the values that they were learning in the school, which transcended all their activities and were able to inform their activities in so very many ways. So just one hopes that within that context of education, that these people are being prepared to take their rightful role in the transformation of this nation.
Thanks there to Bishop Arthur Roach of Leeds visiting El Salvador for the 30th anniversary of Archbishop Romero's assassination. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.